You're listening to Fourth Estate, the show where journalists talk journalism, coming to you from 2SER in Sydney on Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation, right across Australia on the Community Radio Network, and directly to your device across the globe via podcast. My name's Olivia Rosenmatt. Coming up on the show, we'll explore the details of the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission's digital platforms inquiry. We will make it more interesting than that sounds. We'll talk about the tweet that almost took down a social media platform, and we're looking at a new initiative in Good News Stories. In the studio is news editor with Ad News, Arvin Hickman. Arvin, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
The managing editor of Junkie Media, Rob Stott.
Evening.
And joining us on the line from Melbourne is Bhakti Puvanantharan, associate editor at Crikey. The Australian Competition and Consumer Commission on Monday opened the call for submissions to their digital platforms inquiry, which was launched at the end of last year to investigate the impact of digital platforms, basically the big tech giants, on the supply of news and journalistic content and their impact on media content creators, advertisers and consumers. It's the first inquiry in the world to focus on the tech giants at this level, and it's even more significant because the ACCC has the power to compel companies like Google and Facebook to answer questions about their use of data and the cost to media of their dominance in the Australian advertising market, for example. And the ACCC says it has the power to bring criminal charges if they don't comply. The inquiry will take Facebook and Google as its starting point, as the dominant social media platform and the dominant search platform, respectively. But ACCC Chairman Rod Sims told ABC Radio that beyond those points, we go in with a completely open mind about what really is going on and what can be done about it. Now, the inquiry's frame of reference includes questions around the bargaining power of the big tech platforms in the media and advertising market and how that market has changed. It also aims to quantify the platform's impact on the ability of local news media to adequately fund itself and how technology has changed the way consumers access news. In regards to personal data, the inquiry will look at what exactly is being collected and how it is used by the big tech platforms. And they're looking at how the use of algorithms affect the presentation of news for digital platform users. And they are seeking input from consumers, media organizations, digital platforms, and advertising agencies. So if you've got something to say, now is the time. Arvin, many media executives often complain about just how much of the advertising market Google and Facebook suck up here in Australia. Mm-hmm. Do you have any idea exactly how much they're taking?
Yes, it's all a little bit hazy because Google and Facebook aren't overly transparent about how much ad sales or revenue they book in this country. But the estimates that I've received from various people in the industry, it's about $3.4 billion annually. Now, to put that into context, that's about 40% of all online advertising revenue. And what's even more concerning for a lot of the media players is that all the growth in online, about 80% of online sales revenue growth, is going towards those two companies.
Bhakti, on that point there of algorithms, now the tech giants have always deliberately kept their algorithms very secret. Do you think that they're actually going to bend to this threat of legal action in Australian courts and share it?
The question of whether tech giants are going to change in one jurisdiction when it might set a precedent for how they are treated by other jurisdictions is a really interesting one. I think from their point of view, I guess it's comparable to, say, legislating of Uber and the kind of regulatory dance that happens there. I think it'll be a similar question, but I know the ACCC are saying they're going in with an open mind, but obviously we all know that there is a kind of environment around this. There's a backstory to this. There's a Senate report that Nick Xenophon, Sam Dastyari and
Scott Ludlam.
Scott Ludlam put together, thank you, last year. Yeah, there is a kind of crisis that especially the kind of major players like News Corp and Fairfax, but also, you know, smaller companies like my own Crikey, which is owned by private media, need to wrangle with. what are the business models here?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up those senators, Bhakti, because I think it is worth us stopping to note here how this inquiry came into existence. So it was the initiative of a single, now former senator, Nick Xenophon, and was conceded by the government in exchange for Xenophon's support for the government's media ownership changes, which have been widely criticised by many in the journalism industry for exacerbating Australia's already pretty dire media concentration. So in light of this almost nonsensical path to the inquiry's genesis and the fact that Xenophon, as well as the other two senators you mentioned, Bhakti, Labor Sam Dastyari and the Green Scott Ludlam, are no longer in the Senate, Rob, how much government support do you think we can really expect this inquiry to receive, and really, realistically, how far do you think it will go?
I think that's a really big question. I mean, I was very excited about the prospect of that, you know, earlier Senate inquiry actually getting up and making some solid recommendations. They seem to be heading in a pretty good direction. Obviously, that's fallen apart because of, you know, it turns out half of our Senate was full of foreigners or Chinese spies. I think, though, hopefully some of the goodwill that came out of that Senate inquiry can flow on to what the ACCC is trying to do now and can try to benefit, you know, try to come up with some plans to, that will genuinely benefit publishers. Because there's no doubt that, you know, over the last few years, publishers have really become kind of subservient to these huge platforms and the huge influence that they wield. Whether the government is going to be sympathetic towards publishers now, I don't really know. You know, Facebook and Google in particular, they got a lot of money, they got deep pockets, they got a lot of lobbyists. I don't know what it's going to look like in 6 or 12 months, but, you know, fingers crossed that someone can keep fighting for particularly smaller publishers in the way that Xenophon, Dastyari and Ludlam were trying to do last year.
I think also that what you said about the lobbyists is on point. And I think what this does is, if you look at the bigger picture, it really is an investigation in whether ad-funded business models for publishers still work, and whether the two tech giants, in taking a lot of share, essentially eating the media players lunch, whether that is anti-competitive. And I think it's going to be quite difficult for the ACCC to definitively answer that, and whether it receives government support or not, time will tell. But hopefully it does something to curtail the ongoing dominance of these two players, or at least lay a foundation where they can play a little bit more collaboratively with publishers to help them realise more value in the market.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an interesting point, Arvind, because I feel like many people in the industry would already be saying that it's pretty conclusive that ad-funded business models for journalism don't work. I mean, we've spoken in the past couple of weeks on the show about the New York Times' success in getting subscribers to actually pay, and also the trouble that a lot of Australian news organisations are having in making those news organisations pay. But I don't know. I mean, don't you think that that question's kind of already been answered?
Well, it probably has. But I mean, you've got to look at how Facebook and Google are impacting the market, and it's largely through the advertising revenue and advertising revenue share they're taking away from traditional players. So that has to be considered. And it also has to be considered how much, and I hate to play the devil's advocate here, but how much media companies have actually facilitated this in terms of using these platforms for distribution when it suited them, until they realised that it actually wasn't doing them any good.
Last year, Google was whacked with a record fine of 2.4 billion euros, which is about 3.75 billion US dollars, by European Union competition regulators for illegally favouring its own shopping service. But the value of Google's parent company, Alphabet, is close to $800 billion, which is a little over a trillion Australian dollars. So, Bhakti, how much of an impact do you think that these kind of fines actually have?
I mean, the numbers you just said out loud mean nothing to me. They're so enormous that I think most people would struggle to comprehend them. A fine is not what's going to lead to significant change. You know, Crikey is a subscription model, and it's interesting that you brought up subscription models, because I think when it works, when you have enough subscribers, that is almost a perfect model, because the people who are there for the right reasons. It's not, and you know what the mission of the organization is, and you deliver on that mission. And in some ways, advertising is not necessarily what Fairfax and News Corp and certainly, you know, the small players should be focusing on. This is kind of, I think most journalists in Australia wouldn't even know this inquiry was happening because they're focused on kind of breeding reader loyalty and all those kinds of things that make a business sustainable.
Let's talk a little bit about personal data. Now, I have a favourite quote from a man called Jonathan Taplin, who wrote a book called Move Fast and Break Things, How Facebook, Google and Amazon Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy. And Jonathan Taplin says that Google is in the extraction industry. Its business model is to extract as much personal data from as many people in the world at the lowest possible price and to resell that data to as many companies as possible at the highest possible price. Now, if we take that metaphor and look at how much success government has historically had in reining in and compelling mineral resource extraction companies to behave ethically, Rob, should we just lose all hope immediately?
Yes, probably. I mean, you know, these companies have been incredibly successful. You know, you don't need me to tell you that Facebook and Google dominate the internet. I guess it's up to consumers how much of that data we give up and what we allow companies to do with it. But, you know, it seems like I feel like that battle was lost a long time ago. And the answer from most people seems to be they don't particularly care how much of their data is out there. What that means for the news industry, I don't really know at this point. But you know, there's no doubt that, yeah, I think the ship has sailed on that.
Do you think, though, that people don't particularly care because they're just simply not aware of how much data they're giving up and how that data is being used? I suspect a lot of people on Facebook really don't know exactly what Facebook does with its data, not just on platform, but Facebook also tracks off-platform data as well. A lot of people wouldn't know that. And I think the data thing is important because one of the reasons why Facebook and Google are so successful at selling advertising is because of the data. And it's because they're able to use that data to help identify what people think, what their interests are, and really help advertisers target them. So I think the data thing, I think that's a really interesting space. And yes, you may be right, Rob, the ship may have sailed on that. But hopefully the ACCC can have a really long, hard look at that and perhaps, if at the very least, help these big tech giants make data usage more transparent for the consumer.
Yeah, I absolutely think that this is the most important part. And this is, in fact, the part that it makes sense for the ACCC to be involved. You know, in some ways, this is not a consumer issue. In some ways, this is a political issue. It's a business issue, but it's not necessarily a direct consumer-facing issue. In this particular instance, you know, you're absolutely right that most people are not aware the extent to which Facebook and Google will be using everything you do and what they know about you.
I do agree, Arvin, that people don't know that. But I think when they learn that, will that take them off Facebook? Will that stop them?
Not. I don't think it does. My experience is when you do try to talk to people about this or tell them about it, for the most part, they go, I don't really care. Or in a lot of cases, they go, you know what, if that means I'm getting served content, I mean, no normal person ever says the word served content, but if that means I'm getting served content that is actually more relevant to me and makes my experience better, then like, go for gold. The reaction of, you know, regular people out there who don't spend their time in radio studios talking about this stuff is they just don't really care that much.
Yeah. The ACCC is providing a preliminary report at the end of the year in December 2018 and their final report by the 3rd of June 2019. Now, I looked at those dates and when all of these platforms could have changed 7 times by then, would have changed their algorithm 10 times. Like, is this just way too slow and outdated a model for the ACCC to be using?
Possibly, yes. And it gives the lobbyists a lot of time to help influence the final report as well.
Yeah, that's a good point. You're listening to Fourth Estate. Last week, one tweet wiped $1 billion off the market value of Snap Inc., the parent company of Snapchat. That tweet was by Kylie Jenner, who, for those who don't know, is a 20-year-old US celebrity famous for being part of the Kardashian clan and the reality TV appearances, modelling and all the socialite stuff that goes along with that. Now, she, of course, has a huge social media following. So when she tweeted, "So does anyone else not open Snapchat anymore? Or is it just me? Ugh, this is so sad," to her 24.6 million followers, it was a big deal. Now, wouldn't it be entirely fair to say that the tweet alone caused the massive crash in Snapchat's value? Investors have had fears for a while now because Snapchat has user growth issues, which is such a lovely Silicon Valley euphemism there. And a recent redesign, which was supposed to fix all the problems of the platform's usability, was not well received by users at all. So all of this got me thinking about how much Snapchat is still being used for the news. Now, as Snapchat grew in popularity, a lot of news companies flocked to the platform and invested significant time and money in creating content specifically for it. But what's actually happening there now? I personally could never understand Snapchat's appeal, but I think I'm just that little bit too old for Snapchat. But I did spend some time on it today. And locally, it seems like news.com is big on the platform, as well as BuzzFeed, Daily Mail, Vice, a lot of health and entertainment-y kind of stuff, food stuff, what I might call news light. But elsewhere, and especially in the States, there are more serious news organizations trying to report more serious news on the platform. And for those who are not initiated with it, basically, the format of this news on Snapchat is like a series of slides of images or videos with a few words or maybe a couple of sentences superimposed. Do any of your news publications present content on Snapchat?
We do a little bit. We've got Punky, which is our kind of Gen Z-focused title, does do a little bit of content on Snapchat, but it's at the very base level. It's basically just creating stories and having a little bit of fun. It's certainly not creating content that sits natively on the platform. And I think that's where smaller publishers in particular face a huge obstacle on something like Snapchat, which is the amount of resource that you have to pour into something in order to create content that exists only on that platform and still works for the user. There's a huge cost barrier that you've got to get over, and you need to be able to do it at scale to reach a really large audience in order to make that cost worthwhile. And I'm just not sure it's there for most publishers.
What do you think, Bhakti, about delivering the news in these Snapchat stories?
Oh, I think that it's a wonderful opportunity. I mean, I would say most people now prefer Instagram stories to Snapchat, despite the fact Snapchat kind of pioneered this kind of sliding tile format of telling stories. It's compelling. It's, you know, I call Instagram stories friends TV, and there's something... Because, you know, it's my friends posting videos about what they're doing with their day. And there's something very compelling about switching between a friend's baby video and then having a story come up behind it that, you know, might explain why, you know, gun control is an immovable issue in the US. That is very compelling. I think the visual side can be done very well. I think what Rob touches on has resulted in lots of very bad use of the platform. So I think there's a lot of lost potential there.
Arvind, what do you reckon? Is that bad for younger generations' news consumption and news literacy?
Look, I don't know if it's good or bad. I don't necessarily think younger people are going to Snapchat for their news. They may use other social media platforms like Facebook or Twitter. We use Snapchat purely at industry events and in a very fun way, but we don't really use it to create content or new content or disseminate information in that way. What I would say about Snapchat, I actually think Snapchat's biggest problem isn't Kylie Jenner. I actually think its biggest problem is Instagram, and I think it was touched upon. Instagram is pretty much copying every good feature that Snapchat has, but with far more scale. And I think it's a natural competitor, but it's got the deep pockets of Facebook to fund it. And that's where I see Snapchat in trouble in the medium to long term. As far as news, I don't know. I haven't really seen any examples personally, and I don't use a platform very often. I haven't seen many good examples of media or news organizations using it particularly well. But that may just be because they're not investing enough in it, or maybe it's just not a primary focus for them.
Well, one news organization that is spending a lot of time, not specifically on the Snapchat platform, but this sort of tile story format, is the Washington Post. So they're doing some really interesting experimentation in producing these tile-based stories off the platform in collaboration with Google so that they can house it on their own site and it's much more shareable because it's not restricted to just the one app. Rob, you talked about sort of the cost barrier and the fact that it's very limited within the app. Do you think that this is a better solution and that this will kind of encourage the growth of the format?
Yeah, I think it's good that larger publishers like the Washington Post are doing that. And I think in Australia, news.com.au and the Daily Mail are two examples that do create content specifically for that type of platform. And, you know, I don't know what the results of that is for them, but it's an example of them creating native content for those platforms that seems to work as a kind of user experience. Again, though, I think most publishers in 2018 are really thinking about the best way to spend their resources, you know, diminishing resources, trying to reach a larger audience. You've got to make choices about where you do and don't choose to spend money. And I don't really see a lot of Australian publishers choosing to spend their money on that sort of content at this point.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's interesting to note that the Washington Post has done a series, a lot of different pieces. They've done stuff on the Syrian war, but the biggest success they've had is on a story that is about how to make cold trip coffee, which is just even more funny because you just literally put coffee into cold water. but I think, yeah, it's kind of an interesting indication on the kind of content that might work best on that platform. You're listening to For the State. You're with me, Olivia Rosenman, and I'm speaking to Arvin Hickman, Rob Stott, and Bhakti Puvanenthiran. The Guardian has launched a new series called The Upside, presenting good news stories about innovations in solving the world's most pressing problems. The series will run for 6 months and will feature a mixture of reportage, investigation, video pitches, and interviews to, quote, celebrate and amplify solutions focus stories on subjects including climate and clean energy, healthcare, women, community leadership, science, and technology. So basically, it's like the opposite of another article about gender inequality in Saudi Arabia, for example, or corruption in China or melting Antarctic ice. So in contrast, the first piece of the series was all about how stable, safe, healthy, and well-governed Finland is. Now, we should note that the series is sponsored by the Skoll Foundation, which is a private foundation based in Palo Alto in California, who describes its mission as to drive large-scale change by investing in, connecting, and celebrating social entrepreneurs and other innovators. And it was founded by Jeff Skoll, who was the first employee and first president of eBay. In launching the site, The Guardian said they did a pilot and proved that people want to read good news. They said readers are tired of the avalanche of awfulness and are switching off. What do you guys make of this? Good idea? Bad idea?
I think it's a good idea personally, but I think a lot of it will boil down to the strength of the content. I think a lot of people are quite open to inspiring content and learning about new things. But yet again, it just depends how good the content is, whether they see it as something new, inspiring, and interesting, or whether it's got more of a commercial aspect to it, where like it's sponsored content or something along those lines.
Yeah, I mean, it's not surprising that, you know, any content that you create in 2018 in this kind of social world where the idea of any story is that you want people to share it with their friends, whether that's on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, wherever it is, the idea of any story is that you want someone to go, this story resonated with me so much that I need to share it with the people who I know and care about. It's not surprising that positive news, happy news is going to do that. The aim of any story is to make people feel something. And if, you know, the thing you're trying to make them feel is happy and positive, great, go for it.
But do you think people are more tired now of, I mean, news has always been bad news. It's always been natural disasters, death, destruction. Like, do you think people are more tired of it now than they have been previously, Bhakti?
Yeah, absolutely. I do. So this is something we talk about in the newsroom a little bit. Quacky in particular, our focus is obviously politics, media, culture, how society works, and unpicking the kind of things that make it work. And it can be really easy to be swamped by all the negative forces that make society work. And so, and sometimes we're cheeky and sometimes we're curious and, you know, sometimes we are just kind of saying this is terrible. But one thing we have noticed is that people are, I think the positive to neutral to positive space is one where people just want to know more about the world around them, and you don't need to give them a point of view on that. You can kind of present that in a kind of way that gives them an action point. I mean, there was a great project that FFF did for a while called The Vocal, which was very much about action-oriented, positive community kind of stories, and whether that was a global community or a local community. And I think there really is a hunger for that. And I do think people are more tired now because they have more ways to access news. And so it's just sheer maths.
It is worth noting, though, that The Vocal was cancelled by Fairfax.
I think, you know, if a story is really good, it's really interesting, it's really engaging, and it makes people feel an emotion, then it's going to do well. I'd use the example, you know, if you go on Facebook, for example, if I go on my Facebook, a lot of the stuff that people share, sometimes it's really inspirational human stories, little video clips or whatever. So that stuff, people do like that sort of stuff. So I certainly think, you know, if it's done well, I think it's a good thing for The Guardian.
The concept of solutions journalism is not actually new. But Rob, do you think that by associating it with sponsored content, they're kind of cheapening its worth?
No, I don't think so. I think telling good stories, no matter how you do it or how you fund it, is totally fine. I think it's not surprising that you always want a mix of content. You know, the old cliche in news is that if it bleeds, it leads. But there has always been a balance of content, and whether that's on newspapers or online, you always want a mix of different types of stories. The fact that The Guardian has chosen to package it up in this kind of little, you know, put a little bow on it and say, hey, here's this exciting new project, here's what we're trying to do, that just seems like a different way of promoting positive content, probably the sort of positive content that they've always done. It's just a different way of selling it.
Unfortunately, that is all we have time for on Fourth Estate. Thank you very much to my guests. Arvin Hickman, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Rob Stott, thanks for coming into the studio.
Cheers.
And Bhakti Puvanantharan, thank you for joining us on the line.
Thank you.
And don't forget, you can subscribe to the Fourth Estate podcast so you'll never miss an episode. And if you're already a subscriber, please leave us a review on your podcast app or on Facebook. It does help us to know what you like, and it really does help other people to find the show. You can stay in touch with us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is Fourth Estate AU. My name's Olivia Rosenman, and you can catch us at the same time next week on Fourth Estate.